John Lee from the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Illinois, who will be sitting with us today. Welcome.
Thank you.
And the first case of the day, Levesky versus ITT. Mr. Labaton?
Yes, sir.
Please come to the lectern.
May it please the court. My name is Mark Labaton. I'm with the firm Motley Rice, and I, along with my co-counsel at firm Plouffe Shatley, who are at the counsel table, represent Ms. Levesky. The first thing I would like to do, Your Honors, is focus the court on the key differences between the allegation in the prior Graves complaint and the key allegations, the core allegations, in our complaint. And I'd like to do this from the perspective of an investigator, because that's what this court's recent decision in United States versus Goldberg requires the court to do in such situations. Now, I want to begin by just focusing the court on the key core paragraph of the Graves complaint. And this is what the characterization of that complaint was. This was the comparison that the district court said was the key core paragraph of that complaint. And it's paragraph 56, Your Honors. And the key sentence there is that the relators alleged in that complaint that ITT's salary administration program for admissions and recruitment personnel provided in part for the payment of a 5% of earned revenues for inside representatives and 10% of earned revenues for outside representatives. And now, Your Honor, I'd like to focus you on the key core paragraphs of our complaint, and those can be found, Your Honors, on paragraphs 32 through 34 of our second amended operative complaint. And Judge Lawrence, prior to this dismissal by Judge Pratt, this case was ready to be heard for summary judgment. Discovery was completed. The case was set for trial. Judge Lawrence found, based on these specific allegations, Your Honor, that our complaint satisfied Rule 9b's particularity requirements. And these are the three core allegations in paragraphs 32 through 34. While continually reminding sales representatives to meet sales targets to obtain raises and stay employed, ITT corporate employees and Troy campus directors never discussed tactics to meet non-sales targets that were included in sales representatives' yearly review, such as assisting the school in meeting attrition, budget, being a team player, appearance, and attitude. Paragraph 33. During her reviews as a sales representative, relators asked Steve Sorensen, Patricia Hyman, and Robert Martin how her success in helping ITT Troy campus obtained the attrition rate set by ITT corporate was evaluated. She was never given a clear explanation of what attrition rate meant or how it was calculated, nor how her rating for appearance, attitude, and being a team player were evaluated.
Mr. Labaton, if I could ask you a question.
Sure, Your Honor.
The allegations in Graves that, generally speaking, the compensation in the recruiting/sales department was based in part or in whole on enrollment. Wouldn't that be sufficient to provide the government with notice that something was amiss in the recruiting/sales department generally, sufficient to encompass the allegations that are more specifically perhaps set forth in the complaint at issue here?
No, Your Honor, it would not. And it would not in at least two material respects. First of all, we have two sets of allegations in this complaint. The first set relates to recruiting fraud. The second set, which is entirely different, relates to financial aid fraud. That second set was totally absent from Graves. Totally. Not one single allegation. And we have substantial allegations of financial aid fraud in our case. But with regard to recruiting fraud first, Your Honor, if an investigator armed with the recruiting fraud allegations came to ITT and said to the folks at ITT, hey, you're paying a 10% per recruiter per head allegation, ITT would immediately say, that's not what we're doing. We're not doing anything of the kind. Look at our evaluation system. Look at our evaluation forms. Look at everything we've done. And you will see that what we're doing is paying based on a whole criteria of evaluation. We're looking at appearance, teamwork. We're not given a set commission. We have evaluation forms. We have a system. We're not giving any 10% commission. We're doing something totally 100% different.
If someone isn't performing well as a recruiter, how do they lose their job? Why would they terminate them? What would be the criteria for an unsuccessful recruiter?
Would they be terminated if they?
It's a business. You know, they're not succeeding in recruiting. What's the criteria for whether an employee is good or bad?
Well, Judge Mannion, the school has quotas. Now courts have differed as to whether. Employing quotas is a direct or indirect violation of the recruiting ban. There's no doubt that the school can consider recruiting as a factor in evaluating and terminating an employee. But here you had a purported compensation scheme that the school was pretending to have a facade, you know, and looking at a whole bunch of factors in determining raises, determining bonuses, determining all the sorts of compensation, and it was false. And the statutory congressional ban forbids it. A school can terminate an employee for a variety of reasons, including not getting along with
others, not a good appearance.
Right.
But if they're not making their quota.
And if they're not making, well, there is a court opinion in D.C. by Judge Edwards, who calls into doubt whether they can even have quotas. The quota itself might be a direct.
I'm just using your word.
Right. A violation. But our complaint here is not with the termination requirements of the school. They have a right to terminate employees under certain conditions. Our complaint here is that Congress, because of its concern with the kind of recruiting practices at issue with this case, put in a ban on recruiting by numbers, either directly or indirectly. And what this school has done, it is put up a facade, because it's convenient probably for its business model to pretend it's complying with the law when it's not. Now, the allegations in Graves, in answer to Judge Lee's question, were direct, overt, and that's why the school wouldn't know of them. And they wouldn't know at all about the financial aid the financial aid activity that we've alleged, because if we assume, Your Honors, that they had a perfect recruiting program and it was the model and they complied in every way with the law, if they still were violating the law with regard to financial aid, we'd have an entirely independent case and cause of action. Which, as Judge Lee, in response to Judge Lee's question, would not have, no investigator would have been alerted to. And that the key language in Judge Easterbrook's opinion in Rush requires this. It says, similarly, no one who read the GAO report or follow the progress of the PATH audits would know or even suspect that Rush University was misrepresenting the immediate availability of teaching physicians during concurrently scheduled procedures. Same thing here. The investigator goes to ITT, armed with the knowledge that they were paying a 10% compensation, they would not be alerted to the specific recruiting fraud here, much less the financial aid fraud allegations in our complaint. I'd like to, Your Honor, move on and talk a little bit. And again, you know, Judge Mannion, we're not disputing that a school under certain circumstances could terminate an employee. What we're saying is that this school had designed a system to pretend they were complying with the law that was a facade, because they pretend to evaluate based on a whole bunch of criteria, and they didn't. And they paid money to recruiters to encourage them to recruit and bring in the business model is to bring in more students, but they have a problem. The law requires them to not directly or indirectly compensate the recruiters.
Mr. Lapton, are you contending in your Second Amendment complaint that this facade that you describe was created to avoid the Graves case?
Your Honor, I don't know why it was created. It was certainly created to create a facade to encourage them to continue the practice. Mr. Graves worked for 7 months at a school in Northern California, there was a safe harbor that came into effect in 2002. But Your Honor will notice on page 7 of defendants' briefs, they mentioned that this safe harbor, in their view, only codified existing law. So they surely had motivation and reason to create this facade earlier. It's a good defense to Sienter. It's a good defense to protect the company from being discovered for practices that would be called into question. But Mr. Graves working at a school for seven months in Northern California. He alleged something. The point is, our allegations, Ms. Levesky alleged something completely different. And the court, one of the court's fundamental errors is that she made her evaluation on the original source question, which is a different question, based not on the allegations of the amended complaint, which she was required to by law. That's clear from the law of this circuit. It's clear from the Supreme Court opinion in Rockwell. It's got to be evaluated based on the allegations that she made. One of the allegations, Your Honor, was that Ms. Levesky was very clear. This was in paragraph 34 of our complaint. She went to a supervisor and she said, "How come my raises, and you know, even though my appearance score and these other purported measures of compensation factor again?" Are changing, how come my compensation is always related to my enrollment numbers? And this specific supervisor said, we have to make sure that everything rises or falls in lockstep with the recruiting numbers.
Mr. Lapton, taking your scenario with regard to this investigator, if the investigator were to go to IT, to the ITT to the institution based upon the allegations of Graves, and ITT would say, oh, well, we'd try to cover it up and say, you know what, that's not what we're doing. We're doing this. Wouldn't a reasonable investigator then follow up and say, well, show me what that program is? And wouldn't an investigator actually investigate what was going on at the institution rather than just taking the institution's word for it?
Well, the investigator might follow up and might not. I mean, Rush, we had very comparable a situation to this, and the court said no, that's not enough to alert the government to fraud. Here, if the investigator did follow up, they would see a carefully designed program that was designed just to cover this up. This was a camouflage and a facade. And an investigator, without being alerted to the specific camouflage and disguise, I mean, they did this for a reason and a purpose, might very well not have seen the reason for the cover-up. This was designed to prevent that investigator from looking beyond the surface. And it's very, you know, the investigator comes. I was an assistant U.S. attorney, and I work with investigators, FBI and others. They come to investigate the allegation that is charged. They follow directions, and the allegation is charged. They come to the company. They say, this is the allegation, 10%. They get all the papers and all the very carefully crafted papers of the cover-up. They come back to the attorney and say, this is it. I mean, this. But here you have very specific allegations of conversations that occurred with specific dates and specific time from an insider in the company here, an insider who's coming and saying as a witness, this is what was told to me on this date, on this date, on this date. Their allegations of a totally different nature. And the investigator here would not have asked a single question about the financial aid fraud. I mean, it's a fraud of a different nature.
Are you going to talk about sanctions as well?
Our co-counsel will talk about sanctions. As you'll see from our complaint, Ms. Levesky's affidavit prior to the amended complaint, there are very specific details of where her knowledge comes from. This knowledge could not have come from any lawyer.
So your opponent argues that there are conflicts between the affidavits and the deposition testimony.
There's no conflicts on substantive matters of anything that Ms. Levesky alleged in the complaint. These are conflicts of issues for trial, Your Honor, such issues as when the supervisor told you that your recruitment numbers were based upon the number of students. Did she use the word based upon? And the witness said she was firm that this is what it was. Things like, you were concerned about your appearance. Yes, I was concerned about your appearance. These are issues at trial. The court has to determine whether the allegations came from Ms. Levesky. There is no question and no dispute that any of these allegations came from Ms. Levesky and Ms. Levesky directly. These are based on conversations, specifically what she had with supervisors. The lawyer in question here was not in the room. The only issue of any substance is whether the lawyer had told Ms. Levesky about a program participation agreement, which is knowledgeable to anyone in the field and is an agreement that the ITT must necessarily sign to get any of the federal money. It does not go to the core of the underlying fraud here, which was this camouflage recruitment scheme. I will, if it's okay with the court, I will reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Right.
And Mr. Howe?
Good morning, Your Honors. I've been reading a very interesting book by a Minnesota law professor, Dale Carpenter. It's called Flagrant Conduct. And it's about the history of the Lawrence versus Texas decision, the Supreme Court's decision a couple of years ago that struck down the Texas sodomy statute. The reason I mention it is that it had an interesting discussion of how that case came to be, which is after Mr. Lawrence and a companion were arrested, they were approached by a gay activist, they put them in touch with some lawyers, Lambda Legal Fund. It's the meeting with the lawyers that these plaintiffs had that led them to think about filing a lawsuit that they were totally unaware of before, that they might have rights, a lawsuit that they weren't even thinking about bringing it. Now, why do I mention that story here? It's because with respect to my client, Plew Shadley, and Mr. Stay's client, Motley Rice, the two firms have been sanctioned. And Plew Shadley has been sanctioned for arguably two reasons that ITT is arguing. One is that we aggressively litigated a lawsuit, and two, we brought a lawsuit knowing that the genesis of the lawsuit somehow revealed an improper purpose. Well, as far as aggressive litigation goes, the things that were being pointed to in the briefs were that our client, Plew Shadley, filed a couple of motions to extend, which were granted, and a couple of motions to compel, which frankly aren't even the subject of Rule 11 sanctions. And I was surprised to see that that was the argument that was being used to defend the sanctions against Blue Shadley in this case. I think the real reason...
Blue Shadley did sign the Second Amendment complaint, though.
They did. That's correct, Your Honor. I think that the real reason that the judge below entered sanctions and that the ITT is arguing that sanctions should be upheld is that they're offended by the genesis of the lawsuit. Okay. In this case, Ms. Levesque didn't know her rights. Ms. Levesque wasn't thinking about bringing a lawsuit. An investigator approached her just like a gay activist approached Mr. Lawrence and led to the lawsuit that yielded Lawrence versus Texas. The fact that lawyers advise clients of their rights and you have discussions beforehand, that's not something that's going to cause Plew Shadley or any other law firm that's in the case to think that we should simply withdraw and dismiss out the case. The real test here is, was there legal merit to the case? Is this a case totally without legal merit? Are there Seventh Circuit cases that can be argued? Can you point to the Baltazar case? Can you point to the Goldberg case? Can you point to the Lamars case? Can you argue how much is enough and craft an argument that, yes, Levesque did satisfy the standard? I would respectfully suggest that regardless of how this panel might rule on the merits, we think that the case should be reversed. But regardless of how the panel should rule on the merits, sanctions should be vacated. Thank you, Your
Honor. Thank you. Mr. Stace.
Good morning. May it please the Court. This case, or this Court said in the LaSalle case, that in areas where the law is evolving or unsettled, or as they put it, the law lacks the necessary contours to give a definition, that is an especially inappropriate area for sanctions. In our merits brief, we cited a pair in each case. That case talked about the public disclosure bar, and what they said there was that the contours of the public disclosure bar is a Pandora's box. The last four decisions from this court on this issue consisted of three reversals of judges who had experience in the aggregate of 78 years, each of whom got it wrong by too narrowly construing what it took to be a qualified relator. The fourth decision overruled two prior cases from this court. It cannot be said that anyone would have thought that the position advanced here was foreordained against the relator, especially since that trilogy of cases, as the district court acknowledged, favored that position. Judge Bauer said last year that lawyers have to operate in the Tucker case, and it's an inherent authority case, they have to operate in good faith, but they needn't be omniscient. That's all I have.
Mr. Smith.
May it please the Court, my name is Wayne Smith, and I represent the Appellee ITT Educational Services. Your Honors, there's two very important points that were never mentioned in Mr. Labaton's argument that I think are very important to understand the record below and what Judge Pratt was doing below. The first is that the relator has the burden of proof to establish jurisdiction. In the court below, in all of the briefing, the relator argued that this was like a summary judgment motion. Much of what counsel just said kind of picked up that same theme again. And he said this is for the trial court to decide, as if the judge below could not make factual findings on a jurisdictional motion. That's just flat wrong. And Judge Pratt looked at the evidence and made factual findings as she was entitled to. So the opposition below, notwithstanding all this facade stuff we've heard today, the opposition below said three things. Graves is different because it's a different time period. Wrong. It's a different geographical region. Wrong. Unlike the relator here, Graves was much more specific. Graves named PPAs in specific jurisdiction. Graves specifically mentioned the Troy, Michigan campus where Levesque worked. Their third basis was that the financial aid administrators were not mentioned, and I want to come back to that one. But the second point was that, as I said, she did make factual.
A much longer time frame as well, isn't it? Didn't Ms. Levesque have a 10-year or more?
She worked there longer.
As opposed to the, 6 or 7 months of Graves?
Yes, Your Honor. She worked there longer, but the Graves allegations
preceded and postdated the safe harbor.
Correct in terms of employment, not in terms of allegations. In terms of allegations, the Graves complaint says from 1993 to April of 2002, this scheme was in effect. Levesky says, I was interviewed in December 1995. I went to work in January 1996. Here's what was explained to me. And as far as I know, every recruiter during my entire 10 or 11 years of employment was paid exactly the same way. That's what the Second Amended complaint says. This notion of a facade never came into this case until two sentences when Mr. Labaton appeared at oral argument on the motion to dismiss. I thought it was very interesting. When we talk about the sanctions issue, counsel was asked, well, was this scheme adopted as a ruse to get around Graves and the safe harbor? And he said, I don't know. Well, their opening brief said it unequivocally six times, and it's just false. It is not possible in light of what Ms. Levesky alleged in her complaint and what she said at her deposition. So it wasn't clear to me in counsel's argument whether when he was talking about public disclosure and when he was talking about original source, because he said for original source, the court is stuck with the second amended complaint, and that's just false. On the original source analysis, the court was entitled to look at the evidence, and the court did look at the evidence, and the court weighed it, and the court made findings of fact. So what is the clear leak?
Did the district court ever find that Mr. Matuszewski's solicitation of Ms. Levesky was a violation of a disciplinary code or code of professional responsibility?
I think her words were, it's as unseemly as it is unethical.
Unseemly, yes. But
she said as unseemly as it is unethical.
So what ethical code provision does it violate?
The ABA canons of ethics.
Because why? What finding did she make on that, other than making that general statement of...
I don't think she specified, I don't think she went into the specifics, but I think it was implicit and clear that he contacted...
She didn't like the idea that a lawyer would contact a potential client, right?
But, yes, Your Honor. And there's several different ways. I mean, there's an ambulance chaser that goes to somebody that's been injured and says, you've been injured, let me represent you. And generally that's viewed as being inappropriate. Here's somebody that's sitting home, has no harm, no injury, and calls and says, I want to sue this school. Will you help me? And I do think she found that to be repugnant, and I'd be surprised if...
That troubles me. It just seems that her opinion, particularly relative to the sanctions, is just dominated by this taste for the manner in which Mr. Matuszewski came into contact with Ms. Levesky. That's troubling me because I'm having difficulty seeing how that's unethical in the specific terms that we use that relative to the various disciplinary codes.
Well, I don't pretend to be an expert on all of the canons of ethics, but as a
presentation is permitted under many of the codes.
I think some advertising is, but solicitation under most canons of ethics, at least it's always been my understanding, is still severely frowned upon, particularly when you solicit somebody. Counsel said, one of the things counsel said was, all she did was get counseling on her rights. Well, she didn't have any rights. See, she wasn't somebody injured. That's the difference. You know, she in the Parnage case he cited, the lawyer there was hired specifically to help the person, to go find out the facts for the person. And to me, this is just like Schultz. The judge in Schultz found this repulsive. The judge in Lopez found it repulsive because he went and found somebody. Now, remember, Ms. Levesky had already consulted a lawyer. It's not like she'd never had a chance to find out her legal rights. She consulted a lawyer. She sued ITT. She settled with them.
FCA claims are a little bit different than employment discrimination.
But it's not her claim.
Lawyers tend to specialize in those types of things.
But it's not her claim. It's not a claim she owns. It's not a claim that caused harm to her. It's a lawyer who's looking for a business. And what the problem with it is, and why the burden of proof becomes so important, is when we get to the original source, she's got to be a direct and independent source. And the cases they cite give them no comfort whatsoever. Balthazar says that you must think fraud is a likely explanation. Goldberg says you must independently discover the fraud. She didn't do any of that. And there's a great overstatement as to what her deposition, excuse me, as to what her complaint and her declaration really say, because as you heard them read, they were very general. The fact is that Graves is more specific, not less specific. Graves said, here's what the compensation plan is, here's how it violates the statute. She says, few people at my one local campus out of over 100 campuses in 30 states told me that numbers were important. That's what she said, and we probed that at her deposition. At her deposition, she was asked, did they say only numbers went into your compensation? She said, well, no, that's not what they said. Well, what did they say? Well, it's a numbers game. Well, what does that mean? Well, I assumed that a numbers game meant they were compensating me based on my numbers. So that's what she said. When we probed, did you think, during your 11 years, did you know the rule? Yes, I knew the rule. Did you think ITT violated it? No. So you have to evaluate all of her testimony in light of the fact that she spent 11 years knowing the rule, never thought it was violated. So when she now says, I have evidence, and that's all she has, is I have some additional evidence from my one campus in their brief. Again, as many of the misstatements in their brief, they say, oh, high-ranking ITT officials repeatedly told her that it was the numbers that counted. Well, she talked to one person outside the Troy campus that she identified in her deposition, Gene Feichner. How long did you talk to Mr. Feichner? 5 minutes. Did you talk about compensation? No. What did he say? You're doing a good job. Keep it up and you'll do well at this company.
What did she say about knowing the rule?
She said that she was informed that ITT could not compensate based upon student enrollments.
Was that while she was working there?
Yes.
And who told her that?
Her supervisors.
So they told her that rule that you can't have whatever you want to call it, contingency or something.
They told her that she could not be compensated based on the number of her enrollments. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So during this time, they told her, someone else told her differently.
Nobody told her differently during this time.
Well, she says they did, at least. She says that they were saying the...
I see what you mean. Yes, Your Honor.
That somebody along the line saying, you know, outside of whatever the law is, it doesn't make any sense to me to keep somebody employed who isn't successful at recruiting.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why you hire somebody to recruit if they can't recruit? Well, I don't know whether you call that numbers or success or something or other. That's all I'm just confused about what... She knew at the time that she was doing. Did she know she was doing? They were doing wrong at the time, or did you only discover that when the lawyer points out, "Oh, this was wrong. You can't do that." Really?
Well, yeah.
Now, that's what I'm trying to piece together here.
Yeah, sure. She was asking her deposition. Did you suspect that ITT was violating the False Claims Act? No.
Right.
No. Did you ever complain that they were? No.
Not if she didn't know.
When was the first time you ever suspected it after I talked to Mr. Matuszewski? What did he tell you? I claimed the privilege. This is just like Schultz.
Oh, she did.
Yes. Okay. Then so when did you conclude that there was something wrong with how financial aid administrators were paid? After I talked to Mr. Matuszewski. What did Mr. Matuszewski tell you? I claimed the privilege. So she has the burden of proof to establish jurisdiction, and she comes forward and says, worked there 11 years, never thought anything was wrong. Talk to Mr. Matuszewski. Know there's a violation. Why did you know it? What's your direct and independent knowledge? Won't tell you because I won't tell you about my conversation. And I'd like to just briefly cover the financial administrator point because counsel spent some time on that. And it's important to look at what she actually alleged as opposed to what they're now characterizing it. She said, in her second amended complaint, paragraph 37, the overall performance level system was the same as a recruiter with some other criteria. Her March 09 affidavit says, the overall performance level system for financial aid administrators was the same as a sales representative. Page 14 of her brief in opposition to the 12B6 motion to dismiss. Compensation is based solely on the number of students recruited and awarded financial aid. The second amended complaint specifically alleges that the practice was in place when she interviewed for the job in December 1995. These practices continued when in April 2002 later became a financial aid administrator. Same brief. Allegations of the second amended complaint demonstrate that the pay raises for relators and other sales representatives and financial aid administrators was based solely on recruitment. Everything she alleged and argued prior to her motion to dismiss being granted was it was all one big compensation scheme. It's just that the financial aid administrators had some slightly different criteria that they were evaluated on.
Mr. Stays, yes. With regard to the financial aid, her job as a financial aid administrator, that was that a wholly different department from the recruiting department at ITT?
It's a completely different function. It's a clerical function, filling out paperwork for financial aid.
Are there supervisors or immediate supervisors in the line of authority? Is that different?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. It's a different line of authority. And one of the things that I think Judge Pratt below properly found that the entire complaint was the standard is partly based upon, again, Baltazar, Goldberg, all the cases that the plaintiffs rely on, says it only has to be partly based upon the public disclosure. And just a brief side note, they keep distinguishing these cases. Well, the government filed a statement of interest. That was always saying that the public disclosure, the industry-wide disclosure isn't enough. That doesn't apply here. We have a specific disclosure and one that attaches us to all the industry disclosures. So,
Mr. Stays, how would you define, then, the phrase partly based upon? Because it could have a broad continuum of meanings, right? What sort of rule would you ask this court to apply in trying to define the scope of that term, partly based upon?
Well, let me start by saying I think it's easy here. You have an allegation that the same company with the same compensation plan during the same period of time compensating people for the same activities was violating the same regulatory scheme. There's nothing different. What Levesky brings to the table, she says, is additional evidence.
Well, but isn't that similar to the facts in Goldberg, that basically it's the same type of violation, the same statute, the same certifications that were violated, and yet there the court found that the two claims were, that one was not based upon the other.
The court in Goldberg, Your Honor, found that they were two distinct frauds because one was, we are saying that we have a doctor there during the critical portion of the procedure and we have no doctor there. And that's why this investigator point, if you went and looked, you'd see whether there was a doctor there during the critical part. The difference is, In the separate fraud, it was that they would schedule a doctor for multiple procedures. So he or she would be there at the critical part of the procedure in each of these procedures. So I go from the critical part of this procedure to the critical part of this procedure. Okay? That's all the GAO report found. But you wouldn't know that I was actually going from procedure to procedure, so I was not complying with a completely separate requirement that I be immediately available during the entire procedure. And so the court in Goldberg said, we have two frauds. We have scheduling, billing. We have billing for a surgeon being present when no surgeon was present at all. And that you can get from one set of records. We have a different fraud that relates to showing that the doctor was actually at that procedure so I could bill for it because he was at the critical part. But the problem is he wasn't immediately available for the other procedure because I have to look and see that he was actually over at this other procedure. This case is not like that at all. This case is exactly like Glasser. The plaintiff in Glasser went to the doctor, was treated by a physician's assistant, and the physician then billed it as if a physician was present. She knew no physician was present. And the court in Glasser said, well, you didn't suspect fraud, as the court reaffirmed in Baltazar. You have to believe that the likely explanation for the conduct is fraud or you are not an original, direct, and independent source. Just as in Glasser, Levesky, they say, well, she knew how she was paid. Just like Glasser, she knew how she was treated. But Levesky never suspected anything was wrong. Glasser never suspected anything was wrong. And as the court of Glasser says, that doesn't make you a whistleblower. That doesn't make you a relator. And again, I don't want to overstate this, that Miss Levesky knew how she was compensated, because that was one of the things that the court below found, is when you look at her deposition testimony, she didn't really know much of anything about it. She was a know-nothing relator. You ask her, well, they could evaluate you on customer service. I never understood it. Well, could they have evaluated you on customer service? Yes. Do you actually know that you weren't? Isn't it fair that you may have been evaluated on your customer service?
She did know that she was trained on getting her numbers up in the financial aid area, trained on the areas that related to the numbers, but had no training on appearance, had no training on customer service, no training on anything else.
That's what she said. But what she didn't know was whether she was evaluated on them. And for example, one of the factors was attrition, which is something that you can measure. And this is important to the company. Do you recruit students who stay in school, or do you recruit students that drop out? And she said, well, I may have been evaluated on that, but I can't control it. I can't control the attrition, so that wouldn't be fair to evaluate me on that. Appearance. What? She doesn't know. She needs training on appearance to know how to come in with a good appearance, and she didn't know whether she was evaluated. She agreed it was fair that her supervisor may have judged her on it. And let's be clear, this is the supervisors at one campus out of over 100. All she is adding to the equation, if anything, and the judge below found she really didn't have any knowledge of the compensation system. But if she had knowledge that was relevant to add anything, all she had, in the words of this circuit repeatedly, is additional evidence. And that's not enough to make you a relator. And in the financial aid administration area, the question Your Honor asked about earlier, what she testified and why the court cited to her deposition testimony in finding that she didn't know enough was she was asked what she did. Well, I fill out the forms for financial aid and I submit them. Well, are they all for federal aid? No, they're not all for federal aid, so they're not all based exclusively on getting federal aid. Secondly, who makes decisions? Well, the federal government decides how much federal aid they get. Well, can the company make a decision? And by the way, the statute only applies to financial aid if you're making a decision on the amount of financial aid. Well, there are a couple of overrides. Well, who makes those decisions? Well, Mr. Lice at headquarters. Well, what do you do? Well, I fill out the forms and submit it, and I say I think we should have a financial need override and submit it to him, and he approves it. Well, the argument they made below was, well, that's just rubber stamping. But that's not. When you make a recommendation to somebody that gets to make the decision, you're not making a decision. So what she added to the financial aid administrator is that she wasn't even covered by the statute. And that's why the court below cited to that deposition testimony in the paragraph where it finds that she does not have sufficient knowledge of ITT's compensation system, and including specifically for financial aid administrators, to add anything as an original source with independent and direct knowledge.
Well, currently there seems to be some consensus. I've seen at least a couple of articles where ITT has some big problems with, some way to call it attrition, but a lot of their students don't pay off their student aid, and it's a pretty remarkable statistic. Now, that's common, and I at this juncture, are there lots more investigation of why that's happening by the government?
Well, there's been a Harkin committee that has investigated, and there are a number of causes. I mean, this is a whole other
issue. Well, I'm only jumping ahead here because there's certainly a problem, and the question is whether she alerted somebody to it or not.
Well, Graves alerted the government. They conducted a thorough investigation, which was settled. in February 2004, 100 armed agents raided ITT's headquarters and a bunch of its campuses, seized millions of documents. Their computers had grand jury that took testimony from God knows how many witnesses, and at the end of the day, and the SEC investigated. At the end of the day, they both said, we can't find anything. So, yeah, I mean, they've been investigating.
When was that?
Pardon me?
When was that?
The raid was February of 2004, and the investigation continued, I don't know, a year, year and a half. So, I mean, they've been thoroughly investigated. The Harkin Committee conducted an investigation that has led to these articles. Again, this is a whole different subject, but the government is schizophrenic. The policy of the government is every student deserves the right to a secondary education, and the government decides the standard. The government says, if you have a high school diploma or a GED, you get to try to get a secondary education. Fortunately or unfortunately, there aren't enough seats in community colleges, et cetera. So the people at high risk, the people that are working full-time, single mothers, that can't go to the public schools, attend the private universities. They're higher at risk, and yes, they don't come from families with money, and if the economy goes down and they can't get a job, their default rates are higher. That's just an inescapable fact of life. Good, bad. If you want everybody to have an opportunity to get a college education, you're going to suffer that.
So what's a recruiter do? Use your imagination. Do you go to an unemployment line and point out what ITT could do for them?
No, and that's...
And if not, why not?
That was the one of the abusive practices that led to this statute. It did happen prior to the statute. What ITT does, and I can't speak for every school, but the substantial schools, they get leads. It's not boilerplate. It's not cold calling. They do send people out to high schools to say, here's our programs. Here's what, if you're not going to go to Harvard or Yale or Center, ITT can help you with this job-oriented education. But more importantly, they get leads from ads. You'll see ITT Tech advertised on TV all the time. And people call in and say, yeah, I'm interested. And that the recruiter follows up on those people. That's a lead. Those leads cost money, and their job is to follow up promptly on those leads, call the people, say, you're interested in coming to ITT, come down and see me. That's schedule an appointment. Get the people in on an appointment. Then when you get them in on the appointment, you say, here's what we can do for you. What do you want? What are you interested in? Okay, here's a program that fits you. That program fits you. Now here's what it costs. Now you can talk to our financial aid person that can tell you whether you can get financial aid to help you do it. And then they sign them up to an enrollment test. In addition to having a high school diploma and GED, they have to pass a admissions test. Pass that test, then they enroll and start class.
If you don't pass it, can you take it again?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Generally, there's a waiting period. It's the same test that, by coincidence, that the I'm Wunderlich. It's the same test that a lot of organizations use. The NFL uses it for all their people that come into the draft combine. It's a widely known and respected test, and it has different variations. It's like your driver's test. You flunk it, you can take it again, but it's a different version.
Okay. I guess it's just the perplexing thing is that there's a serious problem, and maybe there's no solution, especially if you're saying the government will take anybody if they have those two documents.
That's the irony of the situation. The government establishes the criteria, and then they criticize you and the people that meet the criteria. And I think most people in the industry believe there is a problem that needs to be dealt with. And that's why attrition was one of the factors that they were evaluating recruiters on. Because really try to figure out if you're signing up a student that is going to stick around. Don't just sign up anybody, you know, even though they're qualified. You know, it's not in the benefit of the school. Let's be clear. The school doesn't make any money on signing up somebody that doesn't stay in school. I mean, if they sign up and go to one or two classes, it's cost them a lot of money to get them into the class, and they have to refund any federal monies that they've gotten. They have to stay around for a while, even so qualify for federal money.
What is the refund requirement on a dropout?
I don't remember how many classes it is, but they have to attend a certain percentage of the class, and then you can keep a pro rata portion of the money. But, for example, if it's a 15 session class and you attend, I don't remember the exact numbers, I apologize, Your Honor, but so I may not get this quite right, but let's say if five is enough, if you get to keep some money, but then they drop out, you only keep a pro rata share, and the government is very aggressive on auditing to make sure they get their refunds and they get them on time. That's a big part of the federal program. So it's in the school's interest to recruit people that are going to stick around and finish these programs, because the profitability of the programs is having people that stay in the programs.
Mr. Stays, in looking at the Goldberg case, there the court found that the two frauds at issue, that is the surgeon saying that, or the attending saying that he or she was supervising, but yet wasn't available to supervise at critical moments. The court in that case found that that claim was not partly based on the prior disclosure. Here, ITT is arguing that the alleged fraud that took place with respect to the financial aid department is partly based upon the claims made in Graves. Let me ask you this. What are the reasons that one would be partly based on the prior disclosure and the other would not?
Because in this case, the relator herself alleged that the employee compensation scheme was the same overarching compensation scheme that applied to employees in both classifications. In Goldberg, it was alleged as a separate, specific, different fraud from the one that the GAO report had been disclosed. I can't say that had this case been brought exclusively as a financial aid administrator case that it would be as easy to stand up here and argue that Graves was a public disclosure. But the fact of the matter is this relator alleged there's one compensation scheme, and this compensation scheme covers recruiters and financial aid administrators just with some different criteria, and that it was the same throughout her entire employment. And that is exactly, Graves alleged, as I've indicated, that the same compensation scheme, the same time period, the same activities except for the financial aid administrators, that the same statute, the same regulatory scheme was being violated. I mean, as the court below said, they're nearly identical. It would be hard to be any closer. And what Levesky added is exactly what was described in Goldberg. Even if you add details, in Goldberg, in finding these are separate frauds, acknowledge the principle that just because you add details is not enough. And that's what Ms. Levesky adds when she says, well, people at my campus told me it was just about the numbers. Whereas Graves says, here's how the scheme works. They're actually paying you based upon the number of students you enroll, and you get this 5 or 10%. That's much more specific and much more detailed than Ms. Levesky's. Just a few people at one campus told me that I'm going to do well and I'm going to make more money if I make my numbers. I'm happy to answer any questions. I need to acknowledge that my red light is on.
And I know you're at the end of your time, but I'm just puzzled about the judge's sanction order in a number of respects. One, why 15% of the fees for a point forward, and why an allocation to all three firms plus Mr. Matuszewski, because it seems that the roles of each of the firms is quite different. Motley comes in essentially to do the argument, doesn't sign any of the pleadings, yet gets assessed joint and several liability on this $400,000 worth of fees, yet the judge in her footnote says that they're only on the hook for a fourth of it, but it doesn't make any sense if it's joint several. Tell me, well, I'll give you a couple of minutes to tell
me. Thank you, Your Honor.
Why sanctions should each be affirmed?
And her fourth, when it's joint and several, I think she's assuming that they allocated between them and that they all have assets, which may or may not be. I agree with that, Your Honor. But as to the other part, I'll deal with Motley. It's not true that they just came in for oral argument, and there are several important factors here. And this is why I think sanctions need to be highly in the discretion of the district court, who's there seeing it, living it every day. As I said, this concealment facade theory was never spoken, breathed, or mentioned until oral argument. It was not briefed on the motion. Mr. Labaton from Motley Rice appeared at oral argument and in two or three sentences gave a hint for that theory. Following the granting of the motion, they made a improper Rule 59E motion where they laid out this whole theory that it was all a response to Graves, it was all a response to the 2002 Safe Harbor.
Hey, wasn't that Mr. Matuszewski's motion?
No, it was signed, I believe it was signed by Motley Rice. This is there's two 59E motions, I'm sorry. Mr. Matuszewski made a 59E motion on the sanctions. Motley Rice made a 59E motion on the granting of the jurisdictional motion. And the court below found that that was an improper 59E motion because it simply repackaged old arguments and presented new arguments, the new arguments being this concealment scheme to get around Graves and the 2002 Safe Harbor. And I can go on and on and on. They got two extensions of time to oppose the sum. There's 98 docket entries between the motion to dismiss and the granting of the motion to dismiss. We were briefing summary judgment. They got two extensions to file their opposition to the motion for summary judgment, representing that it would not extend the schedule of the case. Their opposition was due June 6. June 7th, they file a motion for an open-ended extension of time to respond to the summary judgment motion in order to take unspecified additional discovery after the close of the discovery period.
Those are not the events for which these firms were sanctioned, right? They were sanctioned for the overall pursuit of the case.
The judge, Your Honor,
there was not a determination by the district judge, or correct me if I'm wrong, that those particular acts you're referring to were without basis.
She specifically found that there was unnecessary proliferation of the litigation, mentioned four of the motions specifically. She said there were numerous motions following the making of the jurisdictional motions, extensive litigation processes. She said those included, and she named four of the motions. She didn't detail every single one of the 98 docket entries and go into what was happening on those. In her order on the 59E on the jurisdictional motion, she pointed out it was an improper motion. She doesn't repeat that detail in the sanctions motion, but that's why I think she gets credit for a lot of discretion, because she was there, she saw it. She didn't detail it all in her order, and if this court were to decide that it is necessary to have all that detail in an order, believe me, she can put it in. Because it
would add to 15%.
Well, it would add to $2.7 million, and she, in the exercise of her discretion, yes, it's subjective, but she, in the exercise of her discretion, said, I'm going to whack it by 85% so nobody can argue it's not a reasonable amount. That's a huge haircut. So, what she's saying is, I'm going to look at the factors that they argue is mitigation, And in the exercise of my discretion, and yeah, it's subjective, but I'm going to whack 85% off of it. So how can you argue that's not reasonable?
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Labaton, how much time left?
3 minutes. Could I have a little additional time? He went over his limit.
An extra minute. You can have four.
Thank you, Your Honor. Okay. Let me go through a few quick points. First, Your Honor, the allegations in the complaint do amount to concealment. Ms. Levesky does say that she was told that on the face that these raises increases should be based on a variety of factors, but in fact the supervisor who specifically told her said that they will rise and fall in tandem. And if you look at the allegations that I referred to, those three paragraphs, you will see that it does allege factually what is a concealment. Lawyers do not have to plead motive, and we don't have to plead their defenses. We plead facts under the pleading standard. And Ms. Levesky doesn't have to know the law. She has to know facts. And she did know the facts. Mr. Smith mentioned that she was only told by one supervisor. I'd urge the court to look at her affidavit before filing the complaint. Paragraph 22, she alleges very specific conversations at specific times by a half dozen or so supervisors and supervisors who told her, even though these raises are supposed to look like they're coming on a variety of factors, they will rise and fall in tandem. That's a concealment, and those are facts. Not legal theories are for lawyers. Yes, she might not have known the legal implications of the facts, but she knew all the facts of a fraudulent compensation scheme from the time she was working there. All of this stuff, and there's plenty of stuff that's in her affidavit that is totally consistent with everything in her deposition that indicates that she knew the facts of the concealment scheme, and nothing in the deposition disputes that she knew the facts of the compensation practices. She knew how she was compensated over a 10-year period. By the way, Glazer case is different. The attorney did totally block any discovery into any conversation. Here, this woman had a 469-page, two-day deposition. And at the end of the day, there is no dent in what she says in her affidavit, which is a specific fact of a compensation system. The court holding is riddled with errors because rather than looking at the facts in her affidavit and the facts in the deposition, all the court does is cut and paste verbatim a few cites from defendants. Rather than looking at the whole context of the facts, the court goes to a Lopez case where the relator didn't know as many facts. But in our case, the relator didn't know the facts. Our relator knew the same facts as a D.C. case that the government just intervened in. The Pittsburgh case that the government just intervened in against education management with $11 billion of funds. Our relator knew exactly the same facts as the relator in that case. In response to Judge Mannion, this industry is riddled with fraud. The Barron's articles that we cite to say that DeVry is the worst of the worst defenders. Mr. Harkin's report is very critical of them as well. The Obama administration got rid of the safe harbor because it's riddled with the industry. Plaintiff's counsel's firm is fighting to get that safe harbor back. As far as they go, we contend that this is completely different complaint, a completely different cause of action from the other cause of action, because it's not enough to allege that you have the same defendant or the same statute. You've got to allege the same scheme to alert the government. But if we're wrong, and if the district court was right, and if they're right, then Ms. Levesky performed a valuable role by alerting the government to fraud that continued after Graves was dismissed in 2003. And there's a University of Phoenix case that we cite from California in which the same thing happened, and the court said those relators performed a valuable role. They settled the counsel for the other side settled the University of Phoenix case. The company continued years later to do the same practices, and a relator came forward and reported that continuing violation, and that was the basis of an action. The factual findings below. I'm sorry, I was talking so fast.
Wrap up that thought. You're at your red light, though.
Okay. We're riddled with errors because the court really does have to look at the allegations in the complaint, not what happened in cases that were unadjudicated before the court with different relators and different facts. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, and thank you to all counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement and move to the second case.